Good evening. It's good to be with you this evening, looking again at our book study. As Jim mentioned, I gave kind of an introduction on Sunday in the message, looking at part one. So this evening, I would like to look into section two. So hopefully you were able to read that. Get a little bit of a context for what I'm going to be talking about. And just as a beginning here, I realize that this topic might be of more interest for some people than others. And I know, some of us really get interested into the political world, and other people just, it all flies by without hardly even noticing what's going on. But I hope that this can at least give us all some insight into how we can think about it. There's a lot of voices in our world today that are telling us what to think, and we just want to think through this, I would say, important topic of politics. I think it's something to really think deeply about. So Sunday, part one, looked at the problem, the pull to get involved, and basically I laid out the ways of God. That was kind of my main focus, thinking of what's one of the foundational things that this is all built around. And I think God's ways, and comparing God's ways with human ways and how they're just different. God's ways are superior and effective, but also counterintuitive, and they don't always make sense to us in our human wisdom. And we just inevitably come to the question, can we mix the two? Can we use some of God's ways and some of human ways? And it's a tough question to really think about. And I think it's just inevitable that at some point we're going to use human ways and human wisdom, because that's who we are. And God can use that. God, I don't want to minimize what God can do through human ways. God can take actions of people who aren't even trying to please him and work his sovereign will through that. But is that what we're called to? Are we called to use human ways? To sit in the seat of power so we can influence and legislate what God wants? And it's a real hard question to answer. And I think more so because there's so many voices, Christian voices, that are saying that yes, we should be pursuing this. So the second section here is looking at what if we got what we want? And it's an intriguing question. What if we got what we want? And think about what are we actually looking for? And it's interesting, he starts out with a story of forgiveness. If you read through, you'd see the story of Corrie ten Boom and just a radical forgiveness that she had to go through. And it's a really inspiring story. You read through that, the abuse that she faced, and then this guard asked for forgiveness, and she was able to do that. And it's very inspiring, but do we want the world run like that? Like, is that guard supposed to have justice for what he did? And he kind of introduces the section with the pull towards laws. We want some type of structure. So what is that going to be? We don't just want every man doing what's right in his own eyes. So I think we can all recognize that there is a need for government. For boundaries, you have to keep people in check. So right out of the gate, he acknowledges, and we agree, that there's something that should be there. We live in a fallen world, and sinful tendencies of humans are on display, and we can see that. But we can tend to see laws as the answer. And we just need the right formulation of the right laws and the right leaders, and then everything is going to be perfect. And so we can have that idea in our minds. That's going to give the foundation that we need to flourish. And he gave the example of Israel. You know, even Israel, that God gave the perfect law to, Israel failed. Israel was not able to maintain. They had God's own law. We talk about getting the right laws in place. They couldn't change their heart. That we can see Israel's failure, even with laws. So to think again of this question, what are we looking for, and what is the pull toward politics? And I think Jim's devotional really tapped into something, looking at the problems. And I actually have that in my notes. We look at problems around us, and we see there's bad things going on. There's injustice, and it gets us upset, and we want to fix these problems. We want things to be right. And I think we can think of it in a way as we want to see righteousness. And I'm reminded of 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 13, where he says, "We, according to God's promise, look for a new heaven and new earth wherein dwells righteousness." So we have that longing. We want to see a world where there's righteousness. And we're looking for that, but we don't see that here. We see problems. And we just want the problems to go away. And politics is offering a solution. And politicians stand up and they say, "We have the answer. We will fix this problem. I'll fix this problem here. We're going to take care of this." And they have the solution. And depending on what problems we're looking at, that dictates what politician we're going to look to. There's different problems people are looking at, and that leads them to the different politicians. And when we find somebody who's saying the same things that we're thinking about, singing our song, you could say, that's when we really pay attention. And we think, you know, that guy, he can fix things. He's talking about the problems. But is that what we really need? And I think that's what this section is really focusing on. Is it just about getting the right person and getting the right laws to fix the problems? What if we were able to get everything that we wanted in government? And some time ago, I heard somebody talk about a magic wand experiment. And I was talking to scientists and asking them, if you could just construct an unrealistic experiment that you couldn't do, whether it's physical limitations or maybe ethical or legal limitations, but you could conduct an experiment in whatever you would want to do, what would it be? And there was some different answers that they gave. But I'd like to think about kind of like that thought experiment. Like if we could just imagine the impossible, and we could imagine that we could select every government leader. And it's not just the people who would be running for office. We could just handpick, you know, exactly the people that we want. And we would want to put good people in, and honest, godly Christians. And we put some thought into that, and maybe it'd be interesting to see what kind of government we would come up with to put genuine Christians in there. And we know that they would make laws that are according to God's word. And what would that do? Would that improve our country? If we could just get the right things in place. Maybe it would start with, draining the swamp, getting rid of the corrupt system that's there. We got a clean house. Interesting to think about that. What if we got what we wanted? There's a saying, be careful what you wish for, because you just might get it. And it might not be what you're expecting. And I wonder if that's not what we might be looking at here. We have this idealized vision of if only. But if that would happen, what would it look like? Could it work? And you know, this is just imaginary to think about it. It's an interesting question to think about, but was there ever a time in history when that happened? When Christians were in the top positions, where all the good guys were in power? And it turns out that there are actually several times in history that you could point to and say, well, here, this is an example of that. And a couple of those examples are given in this section here. He talks about, first of all, the early Christian world, the Roman Empire. And we hear different times about the persecution of the church in early Rome, time of the early church, and probably sporadic persecution. Sometimes it was really severe, and other times it wasn't as bad. But eventually, it was just after the year 300 that there was a man named Constantine. And you may have heard that name before, the Roman emperor. And he actually became a Christian. He experienced conversion. There's some people that question, you know, what actually happened. It was right before a battle. He saw this sign in the sky, by this sign you will conquer, and it was a sign of the cross. So he became a Christian, had all his troops baptized, and then he won his battle and changed the whole official religion to Christianity. He talks about the Edict of Milan. I think it was the year 313. Edict of Milan offered freedom of religion. So this is page 50 here in your books. Freedom of religion to everyone. And this was great. People were tired of the persecution, and they thought that this is now the time when we can turn things around. And it's really hard to think in the right way about what really happened. Because in a lot of ways, it seemed really good, because there's less persecution, and that's a good thing, I would think. But it also kind of changed the whole makeup of Christianity, because Christianity rose to the top. And now being a Christian was not just tolerated and persecuted at times, not just tolerated, but it was promoted by the government. And the church and state just kind of joined together into one, and it became the official Roman religion. And now it came with some perks. There's tax exemption that came along with that. If you're a Christian, you get tax exemptions in the church. It might have been just church leaders. There's a state salary. They got paid out of the state fund. And people view Constantine differently. There's different opinions about it. What actually was that? Some say it was a good thing, and they point out all the good things that happened. It's a triumph of the church, and really this is the kingdom of God advancing and just taking over the Roman Empire. That's one way you could look at it. But there's also some negative things, and it's clear that he brought in a different era for the church. Church and state were one, and at least loosely connected. So there's some good things. There's also negative things. And he talked about one of those, the treatment of heretics. You know, how do you define official church doctrine? There was a whole question about that, and mentions Arius, the first heretic, really. And they banished him. They sent him out of the country, and now anybody who had his writings is going to be put to death. This is the treatment of dissidents. If you don't agree, there's no place for you. They had the power of the government behind that. The church could really do what they wanted. And it's also interesting to note that the churches became filled with people who weren't truly sincere. And there's about this time that the monastic movement started. So you hear about these monks that would just go out into the desert and live by themselves, and they would become hermits, and interesting things that they did. But the reason, at least in part, for doing this was that the church was corrupted, and the church is no longer pure, and there's people in the church who don't really belong there, and they wanted to live above that, and they felt a higher calling, And that's what led them to just move out into the desert to live as monks. So I wouldn't necessarily see this as the golden age of Christianity, where the world empire took on Christianity as its official religion. And it's interesting, the church gained more and more power over the Western European empire. And there's different stories about that. I remember reading one story from the 1100s. It's kind of the height of church power. And there's a story of this one king of the Holy Roman Empire. It's King Henry IV. And he did something. He appointed a bishop that didn't suit the Pope. And the Pope actually excommunicated him. And made the king to be restored. He had to come back and ask for penitence. And he made him wait outside for 3 days, barefoot, just to be brought back into the church. So that's kind of the height of the church's power, where the Pope could pretty much tell kings what to do. And it's interesting to think about that today, how that would work, if that would still be the case. But it changed, obviously, gradually it lost power from there. But the church had a lot of power at one point. And having the power and the ability to make the rules did not necessarily mean that it was a flourishing Christian society. And I remember reading through some medieval history books and just thinking that this is all just a big power struggle. And there's these kings on one side and these other kings, and you get the church involved, and it's all about who gets to tell who what to do. And the church is caught right up in the middle of it. And I'm reminded of what Jesus said, and he gives a story in chapter 7, page 53, about when Jesus entered the one Samaritan village. He talks about how the Samaritan people didn't receive him, whatever exactly that meant. And there was some opposition there. And we see the impulse of his disciples to just bring down fire. Hey, let's just get rid of them. I mean, they deserve it. They're opposing us, and we are on the side of God. We know that, and so let's just take them out. And there was biblical precedent for that. There was a story in the Old Testament that talked about exactly that. Elijah, he brought fire down on some soldiers who came to capture him and just burned him to a crisp, and they probably like that story. That's a story where you get to just show the other guys where the real power is. We're going to bring down fire from heaven. But Jesus' response, it says he rebuked them. That was not quite what he was looking for. And he said, you don't know what spirit you're of. The spirit of bringing down judgment and just bringing others into line, bringing down the fist. No, that's not what we're doing. And I think that's part of what it means to read the Bible in a Christocentric view, basically meaning centered around Jesus. So we could read that story in the Old Testament and think that this is the way to do things. But you read it in the lens of Jesus. What did Jesus have to say? And it really sheds some light. You know, that's not the way we do things. Elijah might have done that, but that's not our way. And that's probably going to come back in the next section, the Jesus way. But yeah, we want to read the Bible with a Christocentric view. Jesus is a central message of the Bible, and even through the Old Testament. So these stories that we read, make sure we have that filter in place, and I think that's important before we just pull out biblical examples. Let's hold it up against the standard of Jesus. So, That's one example. Looking at history and the Catholic Church throughout history, they had power. But it wasn't necessarily the golden age or the perfect society. Another example that he gives, just looking through, he mentions Munster. It's interesting to think about that. They were early Anabaptists, wanted to bring in the kingdom of God by force. It was a failure. The Puritans. I have notes about the Puritans. I think that's in chapter 8. Enforced Christian Ethics. It's the title of that chapter. We can look at the society that the Puritans developed. Now, I don't claim to know a whole lot about the Puritans. I did a little bit of reading. That other book that I referenced, Pilgrims and Politics, that gives a lot more detail on the Puritans. But the Pilgrims, they came over on the Mayflower, and they were one of the first settlers in America. And I believe we can see this as another golden opportunity of creating a Christian society. Here they are coming over to a new place, and there's displacement of native people, so that was a questionable move how they did that. But they had a chance to create a Christian society, and really that's what they were aiming to do. They were the separatists of England. They wanted to come over and just create their own society. That was kind of the vision that they had. Sometimes we might imagine what it would be like if we could take all the true Christians and just create our own settlement. You know, what would that be like? If we could just have, you know, that would be wonderful. But this is a similar scenario here, and I think we can take a lesson from the Puritans. It might not be exactly what we think it might be. Similar scenario, they more or less could dictate what they wanted to do. They could create their own government from a Christian perspective. That's how they set it up. And obviously the church was very closely involved. The church minister was in a position of high authority. He was checking up on everybody. But yeah, like I said, Gary Miller doesn't go in very deep into what all that looked like, but he gives a little glimpse. Talks about the treatment of Quakers and cutting off of the ears, and I don't know if you read through that, just some very harsh punishments for associating with Quakers. Quakers were there non-resistant, and they were similar but different from Anabaptists in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was a Quaker establishment. But they did not like Quakers. And really, the Puritans were very intolerant. If you disagreed with them, they would basically run you off. And it was not much room for differing opinions. And there's a story of Roger Williams, was a Baptist, and this really was not welcome. He was chased off and started Rhode Island. And that's the story of Roger Williams. One interesting thing that I found, they tried to outlaw stylish hairstyles for men. And back then the style, the trend, the fad was long hair. It was really long hair. And there's some quotes about just lamenting over these hairstyles that are obviously rooted in pride and vanity, but they couldn't really do much about it. They couldn't legislate these hairstyles. They had to repeal that. But there's part of the Puritan legacy, you say like that, that lives on today. And it comes from the fact that the Puritans viewed themselves as a city on a hill. I don't know if you've ever heard that quote from John Winthrop. and I didn't write it down, but basically the eyes of the world are on us and we're like a city on a hill. And that was their mentality. Everybody's looking at us, we have to do it right. And that was almost all the more severe in their maintenance of crimes that really are sins of the heart, pride and covetousness. You know, how do you really control that? But that was their emphasis, because they were a light to people around them. And I think there's part of that mentality that is carried on even into today. And it might not be the same exact vision, but this idea that America is a beacon to the world, and that all the eyes of the world are on us, and we have to do it right. America is special and exceptional, and the prosperity that we have is obviously the blessing of God, and therefore we need to spread that to the world. And I think there's that mentality even today, if you look around at things people are saying. And that's a legacy from the Puritans that came from them, this city on a hill. And another case study in the weakness of laws is prohibition. And that's discussed on page 60. When alcohol became illegal, thinking of another example of the weakness of laws. So there's a biblical case that could be made against drunkenness. And there's a time in history where there was a temperance movement, basically people wanting to outlaw liquor. In the early 1700s, the idea was there a little bit, and it gradually gained more and more strength and popularity. There was some leagues that were formed, anti-saloon league, it talks about, but it was building political pressure to close the saloons, close the taverns, and just think of all the good that would do, the family problems that would solve. We could just get rid of the taverns and the alcohol consumption, and that's really going to improve our society. And we're actually able to do that. Come 1920, they finally reached their goal, and the 18th Amendment was passed. It was put into the Constitution that the sale of alcohol is now illegal. And it was a victory, because they won the political battle. But the problem was not that easy to solve. There's a quote from somebody who lived through that time. And they said, from 1920 to 1933, prohibition was going on, and you couldn't drink legally, but that didn't stop anybody. So just because it's against the law doesn't mean you can't do it, is basically what she's saying. People started making their own, and they learned how to do homebrew, and they started using it as medicine. There's medical alcohol that skyrocketed. As medical alcohol usage supposedly went to 1 million gallons per year. And just thinking of ways to get around the laws, all kinds of things you can do. Just because there's a law doesn't mean you can't do it. The story of a mountain man named Bob Childress, Southern Virginia. He became a Christian, and he put away his former ways of drinking and fighting. And he really cared about helping out his fellow, mountain men who were still living that lifestyle. So he decided to help the sheriff. He was going to join as a deputy and help the sheriff in this fight against alcohol. And didn't take long before he became a little disillusioned by the methods that they were using, because he found out that really the sheriff was not really into outlawing alcohol. It was, they would find the illegal operation and destroy it, and then they would just get drunk on the alcohol that was there. And it was really disheartening for him, because he found that it really was not working. Page 65, the little quote there. At the end of that quote, he said, "The results of that experiment," meaning prohibition, "clearly show that it was a miserable failure on all counts." So the idea that we can just build up a political movement to outlaw alcohol, I mean, it doesn't work like that. And he goes on to say that in the end, it's really the values that prevail. Also, he gives some examples on divorce in the Philippines. There's laws against divorce, but there's all kinds of workarounds that you can cohabit instead of getting married, and annulments, and you know, it just, people are going to do what they want to do in a sense. Values are what's going to prevail. Page 68. Values, not laws, will prevail. Just putting a law into place is not going to change the values of the people. And I think that's what was evident, especially with prohibition and the divorce example as well. Just that it was not where people were at. And they didn't see the law as legitimate, and they were just felt perfectly fine bypassing that. Eleanor Roosevelt, when she was asked why the prohibition was repealed, she said, "Our nation was fast becoming a nation of lawbreakers." And it was a concern that, you know, we just have this almost anarchist view that a disrespect for laws. Basically, the ideas of laws were just degrading. So they wanted to get rid of that, so they just repealed it, get rid of it. Moral legislation is rarely effective unless it results from a change in culture. It cannot produce cultural change. So you can make a law if it's already where people are at. But just making a law is not going to change where people are at. And you can, another way to think of it is upstream and downstream. What's upstream? That flows down. And laws are typically downstream. The upstream current is something different. That's the values of the people and what people are thinking, where they're at. And I think that's really the big question of this section. How do we get people to do what's right? And we're looking at the weakness of laws and also the weakness of total Christian control. That didn't really solve the problem either. Christianity on top does not necessarily produce utopia. Sometimes I think we approach it like a discussion I heard regarding different forms of government. And I forget exactly how it was said or what the discussion was, but it was a discussion between different types of government and what works and what doesn't. And this one person was pointing out failures in this certain type of government. You know, this failed over here and it failed here. Why are you still promoting this? And he basically came back and said, well, they just didn't quite do it right. You have to do it a little bit differently. You know, change this and this. And I wonder if that might be our approach. We would know how to do it better. You just have to do it in the right way, and then it's going to work. So to circle back to the beginning, thinking about the problems that we see, we want the problems to go away, and we want people to do what's right. How do we do that? So we see the problems, what do we do? And I would suggest, after looking at this section, that having total control of the government and having the perfect laws in place is not really gonna make that happen. It's not a guarantee. And the real problem lies deeper. And I think we would all agree that the real problem that we're looking at here is the selfish, sinful heart. And that's what the problems are surfacing from. So the problem is a problem of the heart. So if you can change a heart, then you can change society, a true change. So we should be focusing on how we can do that instead of just imposing laws. Towards the end of the section here, he talks about the lost credibility of the church, and specifically when the church began imposing their will on society, on an unwilling public, I should say. And I think that the Philip Yancey quote, that's not in here. He said, Philip Yancey would have said, the more vocal the church became in the political arena, the more negatively they were viewed. So the more they talked about, you know, this is what we have to do, the laws that we need, the more negatively the church was viewed. And he says, he goes on to say, how can we be salt and yeast in a society that views us so negatively? Can we make a difference? I realize it's not all about reputation and image, but how do we make a difference? There's organizations like the Moral Majority and the Christian Coalition and the Religious Right. You've heard some of those before. They were mostly before my time. I don't know much about them, but they were overtly political. They had an agenda to promote Christianity in government, and that, to my knowledge, meant the Republican Party, and there was basically an alliance there, and the tactics that they used often alienated people, and it really pushed people away. There was many examples of letters and comments that were just basically attacks and very, very hateful comments coming from Christians. When it comes down to it, political action is based on non-Christian attitudes, because mercy and humility don't work very well in politics. People want to use what works, and that's often the aggression and the attacking, and we know what politics looks like. That's the world of politics. There's a story that's given in Pilgrims and Politics of a man named Norman Lear. He's with the organization People for the American Way. And never heard that word, that organization before, but basically it's a progressive left-wing organization standing for basically everything you would think of with that label. And he was asked what he would do if he were accidentally named the head of, I forget if it was a Republican Party or some kind of moral majority, maybe. And basically you think of the two opposing sides, and what if you were accidentally in charge of the other side? And he said, I would basically bring the lovers together. And he was questioned, what do you mean by lovers? And he said, well, you know, there's people who say that they love, but they don't really love. Like, he gave some examples, Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson, and just the attacks that they made on him. And he said, they're hypocritical. But there are people who actually believe it, and he would want to bring those people together. And I think it's very telling to think about what he might be able to see if he actually witnesses love, Christian love, in action, instead of the politically motivated right-wing moral majority, whatever you might put in there. Are we known for love? And it's a convicting thought. And I think one of the most profound statements in this section is on page 71. Page 71, the third paragraph there. I think I'll just read that. I believe the greatest damage may be not the millions who have been slaughtered, so thinking of the war efforts of the government, rather it's the way that the church, through political and military involvement, has reshaped people's perception of the character of God and his kingdom. Instead of seeing God's kingdom as something beautiful, winsome, and compelling, the Christian church is seen as no different from other organizations. It says nice things and produces beautiful liturgy, but when the chips are down, Christians turn to force, violence, and political pressure just like everyone else. They claim that love is the way to peace until they really want something. And I just think that's piercing. To think about that, Christians say nice things, they talk about love and they talk about peace when times are easy, but like it says, when the chips are down and when it really matters, then they'll turn to the same methods, the nasty political rhetoric or wartime. I think it's something we need to think about and consider. How are we shaping the perception of God's church? And it's where it really gets hard, because I think there are times when it just seems so right to do that, to resort to these other methods, political power, to use force. But what's that doing to the testimony of the church? And I do see a connection, a direct connection, between involvement in politics and non-resistance. I think those two are really tied together, and it's something I'll bring out later on, I believe. But yeah, how do we make a difference? We want to solve the problems. We want to fix things. If we could get everything that we wanted, is that going to fix the problem? Maybe a little, but not very deep, not very lasting. And along with that would come a tarnished reputation for not living out what we say we believe, because political action involves compromise with non-Christian attitudes and methods. So the question is there a better way? And the next section is called the Jesus Way. So we'll look at that next time, next Wednesday. Read through section 3 and consider that. So I'll open it up at this time. Does anybody have any thoughts or comments or questions?